This is now Tuesday, November 23. Thank you. I'm going to rely on you to give me the date, if you don't mind. The 23. All everybody has your Oreos, so let's twist them open, ladies and gentlemen. Ah, you look at that, and there's that white center, that's luscious white center. What is composed of that luscious white center? Let's see. Let me read off the ingredients. Vegetable oil, that's this stuff. Although this vegetable oil, if it's truly an oil, it's supposed to be what? Liquid, you see. So that is apparently a little bit of false advertising. Because they should say vegetable fat. But they don't dare say the word fat or they wouldn't sell any. So they use the word vegetable oil. Okay, contains one of the more following. Palm kernel, canola, high oleic canola. What do you think high oleic canola is? High oleic. It's an oil that has a high, relative high proportion of oleic acids in it. And then soybean with TBHQ for freshness. Then dextrose. Anybody know what that's a common name, dextrose. You anybody know what the actual compound is, dextrose? Dextrose is actually glucose. Glucose. Dextrose is glucose. And then, so this is obviously the cookie. Cocoa contains 2% or less of the following: high fructose corn syrup, salt, leavening, cornstarch, soy lecithin, and emulsifier, natural and artificial flavors. At any rate, so the main ingredient is sugar. In other words, real sucrose. Enriched colored flour. Now, the enriched flour contains bleached wheat flour, niacin, reduced iron, thiamine mononitrate, vitamin B1, riboflavin, vitamin B2, folic acid. So you got some folic acid in here for you ladies who are going to get pregnant sometime in the distant future. All right, so let's take a scrap here. Let's take a little bite of our fat. Mm-hmm. Now, let's sit in your mouth for a while. What, am I the only one doing this? You've eaten the cookie already, haven't you? You guys, but can't eat breakfast. So what's happening now? What's happening? It's warming up, and what's it doing? It's changing it from a solid into a what? Liquid. And you can feel it melt in your mouth, is that correct? What do you guys just watch? This is ridiculous. Anyway, so they could have made, you see, they have a problem. They have to very carefully control the fat content or oil content in this, because if they made it too oily, what would happen? It would melt in ordinary room temperatures and it would make the cookie all soft and gunky. But they could put too much saturated fat in it and you could scrape on it and it would sit in your mouth like a piece of wax. It would never melt. It's sad, isn't it? Now, in that white stuff is sugar. You can tell by the sweetness. What's happening now to that fat? It's now descending my esophagus and landing in my stomach. What's happening with it? Oh, no, don't tell me it's just digesting. Let's get right down to the heart of it. What do we know what's happening in the back of the tongue? Acid-stable lipase is following the fat down, hitting the stomach. Now, that lipase is going to be doing what? Changing the triglycerides into what? Fatty acids and monoacyl glycerides, or even glycerides, yeah. It continues now into the duodenum, where the bile salts are released from the gallbladder, also pancreatic lipase and colipase, and some other phospholipases that act on membranes and stuff. And they then begin to package that fat and fatty acids into what? Micelles, especially if you have bile salts there. Bile salts, of course, the backbone for bile salts are what? Cholesterol. And so those bile salts make the bile salts and other things make those fatty acids into micelles that then can cross the what? The unstirred aqueous boundary layer. Is that correct? Without the bile salts, the fat couldn't cross it and you wouldn't absorb it. Okay? So it gets in, short-chain fatty acids and medium-chain fatty acids simply move across the endothelial cells. What happens to the long-chain ones? They get repackaged. There's an enzyme, there's a protein that holds on to them and moves them into the endoplasmic reticulum. You need to remember what that is. And get repackaged as what? Those chylomicrons get dumped where? Well, yes, eventually, but what circulatory system do they pass into? Lymph system, the lymph system. Then the lymph system eventually migrates and merges with the blood system, and then those chylomicrons go to the liver and other locations in the circulatory system if they have... what enzyme acts on the chylomicrons to reduce the fats as it circulates? What enzyme is that? There's an enzyme that's in the interior of the capillaries that acts on the chylomicrons. You remember what enzyme that is?
LPL.
Yes, LPL. Does anybody remember what LPL stands for? Lipoprotein lipase. That's right. And that reduces the amount of fat in the chylomicrons. The chylomicron remnants then go to the liver and then get modified and so on. Okay, so that's what happened at your foot. Now, ketosis, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like for you to write that word down somewhere and look it up for me. Ketosis, 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 ketosis. And we'll talk about that on, remind me to talk about that on Monday, if you would. Ketosis, 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 ketosis. Doon, 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 doon. Now, we've done this first page, is that correct? Hello? Thank you. Now, we've all filled it in, is that correct? I asked you to know the structures and so on. Okay, we go on to the next one. All right, structure of cholesterol and light hardening complexes. This is this is overhead number 3 of chapter 19. We're going to quickly go through this. All right, so there's several things to fill in here, please. You'll note that we have the first line is chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B. The next two lines are A and B again. The next, highly conjugated double bonds. Red light is one of the blanks. Blue light's another blank. Carotenoids, phycoerythrin, phycocyanin. So, and then I made you just rewrite them down below. Isn't that kind of cute? So the fifth line, let's see, 4, line 5, 6, 7, line 8 is phycoerythrin, phycocyanin, and carotenoids. Carotenoids. So, these are all light-absorbing pigments that can transfer that energy of the light absorption to a reaction center or to a chlorophyll that can then absorb that energy and use it for something. And we'll discover that. So, it would behoove you to recall the 3 or 4 materials that absorb light that are not chlorophyll. These 3 things right here. It would behoove you to do it. And also what light they actually absorb. So you can take a look here at this diagram. This overarching yellow line here is the solar spectrum. Solar spectrum. The wavelength is 400 to 700. 407 is about the visible light. You can see here, this is high energy. This is relatively low energy. And notice chlorophyll A absorbs strongly in the high energy, and so does chlorophyll B, relatively high energy. Comes down here, there's a large gap, and it comes down here, absorbs down here in the red as well. So it absorbs up here in the blue wavelengths, ultraviolet, down here absorbs pretty strongly in the reds. Notice it does not absorb here where you would consider it to be green. Green. So that's why leaves are green. They don't absorb the green wavelength. Right? They don't absorb the green wavelength. And there's not a lot that does absorb the green wavelength. Then you got the carotenoids that also absorb. They absorb, let's see here, phycoerythrin, phycosin. Notice this phycoerythrin, which yellow and red, this has a tendency to absorb some of the green, and that's why it's right in this area. So suffice it to say, if you have accumulated enough of these different pigments, you can absorb a significant amount of the entire solar spectrum. And so it's a very good thing. If you take a look at the structure, of course, they have chlorophyll right here. And you can see, of course, they've got that porphyrin ring. You see, this is hemoglobin, hemoglobin precursor. You see the same ring, very, very similar in that aspect of it. Magnesium there, iron there, nitrogen and the nitrogen and so on. The chlorophyll, of course, has a variety of R groups on it up there along in this area. And depending on the R groups, they have a definite, definitely changes its absorption pattern. You can see that these rings are highly conjugated. Thus, it drives the transition state between ground state and the next energy level. They drive that energy difference into the visible wavelength spectrum. So it absorbs the visible light. And you see that the P and G are some fairly long side chains. Notice this one. Look at G, this side chain G right here. Where is that? Is that R4? Yeah, R4. Bacterial chlorophyll. Notice the geranyl-geranyl side chain. I wonder where you might think geranyl-geranyl from. Let's see. Where would you think of that? What metabolism was it? Cholesterol synthesis, exactly. All right, well, let's go ahead, shall we? What are they doing with all that? All right, so let's quickly run through this. Let's fill in the blanks here. You've got the first blank is an antenna, chlorophyll, and then 90% efficient. The next blank below that is filled in with capital L, capital H, capital C, lowercase L's, LHCs, light harvesting complexes. Then the four blanks right below each other. The first one is internal. Fluorescence, exciton, and photooxidation. All right. So, are you done filling that in now? Pretty close. What actually is happening here, and this is a nice little diagram. I mean, it gives this kind of a hexagonal kind of shape. But I don't know if you can tell, but within that diagram and in your text, you'll see these darker spots that actually are known as the reaction center. That these hexagonal-shaped figures here in the interior are, in fact, just regular old chlorophyll molecules. And while they will absorb light, they actually do not perform any chemical reactions. The chemical reactions occur in these reaction centers, Now, the reaction center can be struck directly with a photon and behave appropriately, but the majority of energy that reaction centers get come from the antenna chlorophyll that absorb the energy and then simply transfer it along to other chlorophyll until it, by accident, runs into a reaction center. And so you can see here, this photon comes in, wanders around, doesn't hit a reaction center, This one wanders around, transferring energy from chlorophyll to chlorophyll to chlorophyll. It eventually runs into a reaction center. Another photon here goes through a random walk and ends up at the reaction center. Some photons actually come around and then wander around and then re-emit it as another photon at a lower energy, oddly enough. So let's take a look at what happens then. So these light harvesting complexes are the ones that actually contain both chlorophyll as an antenna and chlorophyll within a reaction center. So the energy of a photon, once it hits a chlorophyll, has four fates. There's an internal conversion, as you can see here. A blue photon hits with a relatively high energy, promotes an electron to a second excited state. It can spontaneously vert down to the first excited state, and when it does that, it releases heat energy within the chlorophyll, makes chlorophyll a little warmer. What happens after that is three possible fates. The first possible fate that's listed here is fluorescence, occurs in this third line right here. Now, fluorescence, of course, means that you are irradiating energy at a different frequency than you absorbed. You know, fluorescence is very easy to see. There are certain kinds of rocks, and we've all been to museums in which a whole collection of rocks, is being irradiated by a black light, and you walk in there and see these rocks just glowing these intense blue and green colors at you. Well, that's the ultimate in fluorescence. It's where the ultraviolet light, the high energy light, promotes electrons to an excited state, and then they release that energy in a different frequency. So you radiate it with one frequency and you observe it in a different frequency. That's fluorescence. We could use a fluorometer if anybody wants to donate $50,000 to the chemistry department. Any volunteers? All right, excellent. Thank you. I will be contacting you in about 10 years. I'll be near retirement. My retirement party is going to be just a whole collection of instruments that new instruments for the chemistry department. Never mind. All right, so that's fluorescence. Of course, you absorb red light. You could immediately return that. That's not likely to happen. Absorption of red light is something else. It doesn't have enough energy to fluoresce typically. The next thing is this excitant transfer. That is, a photon promotes an electron, and then this electron simply jumps, promotes an excited state, are these adjacent antenna pigment molecules. So you excite one chlorophyll, but that excited electron then excites another one, and another one, and another one, and another one, and then it moves that energy in a lossless transfer from one chlorophyll to the next. So this thing then they don't show the exciton transfer in this diagram. It's just shown here. Eventually, you get to a reaction center chlorophyll, which is a slightly lower energy, and lands there and doesn't leave. And then photooxidation. So the photooxidation, the electron lands here, and then some chemical reactions occur. All right, what happens? The light reaction. All right. And there we go. So there's, again, several small blanks on this fill in the blank here. We have red is the top blank. The second blank, reaction center occurs in the PM. What do you think that stands for, especially if you're dealing with photosynthetic bacteria? That stands for the plasma membrane. Plasma membrane. Reaction center occurs in the afternoon. Doesn't make a lot of sense. Okay. So, plasma membrane, and then each center contains four hydrophobic subunits, H, L, and M. L and M bind four bacterial chlorophyll, two bacterial phytocytin, which is magnesium replaced by hydrogen, one iron, and two ubiquinone. These groups are nearly twofold symmetry. Two of the bacterial chlorophyll are called a special pair. They're parallel. The magnesiums are about 7 angstroms apart. They absorb about 790 nanometers, which is called P780. Now, what happens with this, okay, in the next line down, so you have the special pair, you got your delocalized. I can hardly keep from lecturing before I start repeating myself. Okay, delocalized, and then last line at the very bottom is called quantum. Quantum, quantum, quantum. Yes?
What's the point of having chlorophyll other than reaction centers if you're just wandering around with small energy losses as a place to find one?
You're talking about the antenna chlorophyll? Actually, the transfer is lossless.
Because you said it emitted a photon slightly lower energy.
If it does. The vast majority of times it does not.
Okay, so there's more reaction chlorophyll than always displayed in that. I mean, there was like six of them.
Right. I'm not sure the exact proportion. There is a larger, much larger proportion of antenna than reaction.
Okay.
The vast majority of times, though, the high-energy photon does run into the reaction center. And so the majority of the energy is absorbed. It's seldom, if ever, re-emitted.
Is that just because that's the reaction center is saturated in this case? Like, if it had more, it would be unsaturated reaction centers, so it would be a waste of energy? Or is what's the
waste of energy? The upper limit on that, yeah, describe what you just said again. I want to make sure I heard it right.
That you're saturating all reaction centers with light, even though there's only a few reaction centers. So in other words, if you had
right.
more of them, you wouldn't quite saturate them all, so
it wouldn't be quite as efficient.
Right.
Yeah. I would suspect that's the explanation. I don't know if we know exactly what the explanation
okay.
is. But that's an excellent explanation for the relative ratio of antenna to chlorophyll centers. That ratio may depend on the species, may depend on whether it's up in temperate environment or down in, near the equator where you have constant high levels of light. Good question. Don't have the answer for it. All right, so the reason for this particular thing is this idea here of a special pair, ladies and gentlemen, a special pair. The chlorophyll are sitting there kind of like this, just flat right next to each other, and they're highly symmetrical in terms of if you looked at it in X-ray chromatography, you could tilt it back and forth, it would be highly symmetrical, their formation. Interestingly enough, however, the following occurs. The absorption of the photon by the special pair excited electron is delocalized over both pairs. In other words, that the electron, the photon that's absorbed, the energy is delocalized over both pairs, so it kind of oscillates between the two. That energy, that high energy segment exists for only 3 picoseconds before transferring the electron to the bacterial phenocytin. Phenophyton on the right of the figure. So that's down here. So the next 200 picoseconds, the electron migrates to menaquinone, and the electron transfer is so efficient the quantum yield is nearly 100%. So virtually every photon that it gets absorbed produces an electron that gets transferred. The fascinating thing is, and one thing that they really can't figure out very well is that... that when the photon hits and excites this special pair, the electron is immediately withdrawn down the right-hand side to this particular bacterial phenophyton and then to this menaquinone. 99.9999% of the time, it goes down this pathway, whereas this pathway appears to be similar in energetic... similar in an energetic pathway kind of way, but nevertheless, the electron flows down this direction to the right, and they don't know why. Special pair, the symmetry of it would indicate that it ought to go down both ways equally, but it only goes down menaquinone, and they're not sure why. You can see here, this is a diagram of the relative energy of this. And as a photon gets absorbed, it goes from a highly oxidized state to a highly reduced state, and it follows this pathway down here to this coenzyme Q pool, then goes through a cytochrome BC complex, and down the electron flows back down here. Now, one thing that's not shown, if you would make this box, and I don't care how you draw it, where the cytochrome BC complex occurs, this is the pump. So make a pump. Uh, So that is a proton pump that's pumping hydrogens from inside the cell to outside the cell. From inside the cell to outside the cell. And that's where that extra energy goes to. It becomes a proton pump, but of course the bacteria have that ATPase that allows those protons to go back in and make ATP. So that's where the bacteria gets its energy from, is pumping those protons and then allowing them to return to the interior and make ATP with it. But the special pair is fascinating to me. And if you would read it, it's not necessarily going to show up on the standardized final, but it does have some very interesting things to say about it. All right, let's go ahead. Now, that was primarily with bacteria. Is that correct? What did I just say? Bacteria? Right? Photosynthetic bacteria. This now deals with plants and what's known as cyanobacteria. Can you see that I was a little nervous when I did this? And so you can see. Never mind. I'm not paying any attention. Let's take a look at this. All right. So this is a two-center electron transport as opposed to the one center that you found before. The next blank is called NADP+. PS2 is water. The third blank is red. The fourth blank is red. And the fifth blank is yellow. This is not surprisingly called the Z scheme, ladies and gentlemen. The Z scheme of photosynthesis. And you've seen this before, primarily in Foundations of Biology. Is that right? Did you see it in Foundations of Biology for those who took that? Okay. For you biology majors, where else would you see this Z scheme? Did you see it anywhere else, biology majors, or is it just in Foundations? Bacteriology? Bacteriology saw the Z scheme? Well, I guess because of the cyanobacteria. What? All right, and that's it? You guys have a plant? You guys have a plant class? You don't have a plant class? What? Oh, you saw it in Cell Molec too? All right. Well, okay. For you non-biochemists and non-biologists, Adam, you better read it. It's fascinating stuff. All right, so let's run through this. What happens, ladies and gentlemen, what happens is the following. You have this right in here. Two-center electron transport. So there's two locations where light can elevate a low-energy electron to a high-energy electron and then immediately be removed from that pathway. It operates in series, some similarities to a bacterial pathway. The PS1 eventually uses those electrons to reduce NADP to make NADPH. The PS2 is what oxidizes water, if you can imagine oxidizing water. PS1 is activated by red light, and PS2 is activated by red light and yellow light. That's why it has this slightly different frequency here. This material blocks electron transport from PS2 to PS1, Z scheme of photosynthesis. Now, let's take a look at what happens here, ladies and gentlemen. The PS2 system gets hit by an electron, by a photon. The electron is promoted from a positive 1.2 oxidation number to a negative 0.8. Huge energy difference. Leaves a hole right here. Leaves a hole right there. An electron blank hole. That hole is eventually filled through the oxidation of this manganese complex. Now, for those of you who went to the AUIQ and saw my question about oxygen evolving complex, I said the answer was manganese. Everybody else thought it was going to be magnesium. I had a couple of people come up to me later and go, "What are you talking about? It's got to be magnesium." I said, "No, the oxygen evolving complex actually is manganese." We'll take a look at that right here. And so you can see here where water is in terms of its oxidation value, and there's oxygen. So you're having to produce such a strong oxidizing environment that it can extract electrons out of oxygen, which is, to me, a spectacular amount of oxidizing power. And so that photon then, that promoted electron gets replaced by a series of electrons being extracted out of a manganese complex that eventually has such a strong oxidizing power to it that it can rip electrons out of water, release oxygen, and then begin to fill in those electrons that are being promoted from PS2. Those PS2 electrons then flow down an electron transport chain. They get end up in a pool where you have this cytochrome Q complex. Again, here is where you're going to start pumping protons. From this cytochrome Q complex, electrons can move then to the PS1, where a photon can promote those electrons, go through another pathway, and then eventually land on NADP to make NADPH. If you don't need to make NADPH, there is a cyclic pathway that allows those electrons to flow back into the pool and then pump protons as they move back and fill in the gap there at P700. So you have a terminal electron pathway that makes NADPH. You have a cyclic electron pathway that pumps protons and makes ATP. And the PS2 is the one that oxidizes manganese often enough that it eventually can release electrons from water to produce oxygen. This is this. Now, am I going to ask you to memorize this pathway? No, but I do want you to know what happens here in PS2 and also the cyclic and non-cyclic pathways of PS1 in terms of the general ideas behind it. The fact that this is A1, A2, FX, FA, I don't care. Okay, if you get into that in graduate school, that's fine by me. Now, here's a diagram of what this apparently looks like. Here is a photon coming in the PS2 complex. There's oxygen being released. There's the electrons traveling through this complex. Then looking at cytochrome C, here's where the hydrogens are pumped. Here's the complex 2. Here's where the iron, and here's where the NADPH gets made. Notice this is... This is the thylakoid lumen on the interior of these stacks. The stroma is this clear liquid outside the stacks. So ATP is made outside the stacks in the stroma. NADPH is made outside the stacks in the stroma. Protons are pumped into the interior of the thylakoid lumen and allowed to pass through back the ATP synthase to make the ATP. So the stroma is where the NADPH is made and the ATP is made. And it's proton pumping from the stroma into the thylakoid lumen that provides the electromotive power for this. Am I going to ask you to memorize this diagram? No, but you do need to know what occurs in the lumen and in the stroma. What occurs in the lumen and the stroma. The stroma is making the NADPH and ATP. The thylakoid lumen is where oxygen is evolved and protons are pumped into. All right. Here's the details on the oxygen evolving center or oxygen evolving complex. Fascinating chemistry, ladies and gentlemen. Unbelievable. We're looking at the essence of life right here for us as mammals and other oxygen-consuming animals. Every oxygen we breathe right now has come from some plant doing this. There's not an oxygen around that hasn't been recycled over the natural history of our planet. Somebody at one time made a calculation and said, based on the length of life of Da Vinci, there we go. You know what I was having to think of? You know whose stupid name came up in my mind instead of... Yes. I thought that twice. No, that's not right. And I'm going, hey, wait a minute. At any rate, so some wag calculated one time, based on the length of his life and how many times he breathed and the fact that the atmosphere is so thoroughly mixed that on average we breathe about 1,000 molecules of atmosphere that was in his lungs at one time. It's a weird calculation to make, isn't it? But it is. That's what they said. So we're breathing oxygen the one time, sometime this season, has been released by bacteria, by plants and other that. So, and they, it's all being released by this oxygen evolving center. That's OEC, manganese, calcium, and chloride. All right, discovery of the OEC came through a light flash experiment. The amount of oxygen released by dark adapted plants peaked every 4 flashes after initial 3 flashes. So what's happening here is you have flash, flash, oxygen release. And so they saw this peak of oxygen release based on the photon flashing. Boom, 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 boom. Just like a flash, a camera flash. So the model then became the following, and that is that there is the oxygen evolving state complex has 5 states, S0 to S4, with the OEC is the resting state at S1. So it's resting here. A photon comes in, relieves an electron. You get a new oxidation state, another photon promotes an electron. Another oxidation state. Another photon comes along, oxidation state, which means you've removed 1, 2, 3, 4 electrons from the manganese, which makes it extraordinarily high oxidizing potential. And after that 4th flash, the S4 state has enough oxidizing potential to remove 4 electrons from the oxygen, from the water, to make oxygen and hydrogen ions and go back to the S0 state, and then, again, be able to produce electrons as the photons hit it. Yes?
A question back to the slide right before this.
Yes.
This would be thylakoid lumen. If you're doing the oxidation, and you're making those 4 proton pressure, why are you trying to bring in more? So you oxidize the water.
Oh, you hear?
Yeah, you already have protons. Why do you try to bring in more and then try to pass those through and make ATP?
These photons, what happens? what eventually happens is that you know, these photons are produced in the interior, you can see here, and allowed to pass through. But notice what happens to these hydrogen protons once you're reducing the NADP. In other words, that these hydrogens that are made eventually pass through, go up here, and are eventually made into NADPH, captured as NADPH. Right.
So if there's a lot of protons on this side,
right,
why would more protons on the outside want to come to where there's protons already? They just want to stay out there and just be used to make NADP?
What's happening is the electrons as they pass through here,
That in part creates
the gradient. So in other words, that the production of ATP exceeds to some degree the production of NADPH. So you have to pump protons in order to get those having the correct gradient to move through and making the ATP is how I understand it. So this the production of the 4 protons here is not sufficient to make all the ATP necessary for the plants for needs for the ATP. So they have to pump additional protons into the thylakoid lumen to produce enough energy to make the ATP for the plant process. So if I understand your question correctly, is how I would interpret why there's both production of hydrogen ions and the pumping of hydrogen ions. That the production of hydrogen ions is not sufficient to create enough energy for the ATP. And you can see that here. If it was, there would be no need for that cyclic pathway. If the production of the hydrogen ions here was sufficient, there would not be any need for that cyclic pathway to pump more protons. And this is the one big problem with having this particular program, is I've now got to go through all this. Are there any questions about the oxygen evolving complex? What happens is that it actually doesn't. how can I say this? What actually happens is it becomes randomized and you can't know to peak. This is an idealized diagram, but what happens is they are producing oxygen, but it does not is so obvious in the peak.
Because
correct. Correct. Grass of difference. So the oxygen electron complex contains the magnesium ions, calcium ions, and so on. Interesting, to me, a tremendously interesting inorganic and organic and biological chemistry. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Have a great day. And have a safe trip. We'll see you back on Monday.